Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and reading and more. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today is another episode of The Stacks Book Club. We're discussing Pulitzer Prize finalist The Light of the World by Elizabeth Alexander. To help us discuss this book about grief and family and creating a life worth living, we have Danny McLean, who is the author of We Live for the We. There are no spoilers this week. You can connect with Danny and The Stacks in the show notes and find all the details of everything we discussed on today's episode there as well. If you love The Stacks and want to support the work we're doing on this show, join The Stacks Pack over on Patreon. That's a place where you can contribute to the work we're doing and get perks and inside access to The Stacks, like our virtual book club and more. To join The Stacks Pack, go to patreon.com/thestacks. I want to say a shout out to Edna Trujillo and Jenna for being our two newest members of The Stacks Pack. Thank you, ladies. If you're new to Audible, you can get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. There's no commitment needed, and any book you pick up through this free trial is yours to keep. It's a great way to get more reading into your life. So go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts and that you leave us a rating and a review. All right, let's dive into our conversation with Danny McLean about The Light of the World by Elizabeth Alexander. All right, you guys, we are back again today with Danny McLean, who's the author of We Live for the We. Today for the Stacks Book Club, we're discussing The Light of the World by Elizabeth Alexander, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2016. And it's the story of Elizabeth Alexander and her husband, who passed away suddenly right at the age of 50. And it's an incredible book. Elizabeth Alexander is a poet, but it's a memoir written in prose, but it has a lot of poetry in it, in her writing. And there are not spoilers today necessarily, but we're going to talk about the book in detail. If you didn't know the book was about her husband dying, that's pretty much the only spoiler in the entire book. But if you want to read it first, I highly recommend reading it. If you want to read it after, that's fine too. So Danny, thank you for being here again.
Thanks for inviting me.
I'm so happy. You picked this book. You'd read it before. You said, I'm looking for an excuse to read it again. And I said, let's do it. And thank you. This was such an amazing book.
You're welcome. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I loved it. I mean, usually we start with like, what did you think of this book? Mm-hmm. But what do you think of this book?
Yeah, I love this book. So this book came out in 2015. And 2015 is the year that my aunt, Pam McLean, passed away. Mm. And she was like a second parent to me. My mom has seven sisters. My Aunt Pam moved in with us when I was 8 years old. And she was like my second mom, basically. And so my book is actually dedicated to my mother and my aunt, mm. Pam McLean. And there's a lot about my book's origin story that is tied up in my aunt's passing. Okay. I haven't really talked publicly about that or gotten into that, but it's true. So I read this book because I read it right after my aunt passed away in the spring of, or maybe the summer of 2015. And I was taken by this book because it talks about grief in a way that I had never really seen grief mm-hmm. written about. And I needed to feel, I needed some way to like make sense of my grief. Losing her was the first time I had lost anyone close to me. And so the way that Elizabeth Alexander writes so movingly about loss and like grief, but also the joy of memory and like love, like deep love for someone who's just no longer in the physical realm. I just felt, I felt really seen by that writing. It helped me make sense of my own grief. So I adore this book. It also is just like so beautiful. I mean, because she is a poet, the way that she describes anything from like the garden, mm-hmm. you know, their yard, to the way a certain dish tastes, to right. watching her sons on the basketball court. Like, it's just so vividly drawn. It's just such a beautiful book. So there's so much that I love about this book.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like the writing to me really stuck out. The poetry of her language, also the appreciation for art.
Yeah.
Because they're both artists.
Right.
And I thought that that was really special
and powerful. And you, this book feels like a piece of art to me. It doesn't necessarily feel like a book, and not, and I don't want to say that in a way that makes the listeners think that it's like not accessible,
right?
Like, or that it's like high brow or something.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly.
That. It's very accessible. It just, it like, I keep like moving my body kind of like side to side. It feels very fluid and like a breath.
Yeah.
Like it just feels very full on, like there's an inhale and an exhale, and then there's all that comes in between, and it's connected, and it feels like very full and rich in a way that I wasn't expecting. Like I read and I really loved Joan Didion's A Year of Magical Thinking. Have you read it?
Yes.
And that's another book that I love. And this book feels different than that book.
I totally agree.
And I don't know exactly why. And both books I love, but this The Light of the World just feels more like rich to me.
I'm so glad that you mentioned Joan Didion. Okay. Like, okay, because yes, right? So Joan Didion's Year of Magical Thinking, and then I think also Blue Nights is the other.
I've never read that.
She wrote one about her husband's passing
and one about her daughter's passing. I saw the play. There was like a Broadway play.
Yeah.
With Vanessa Redgrave was in it.
And I remember.
It's when I lived in New York and I saw everything.
Oh my gosh. I never saw it, but I read both books. And I love that you mentioned that, because those are two books that I hold alongside this book as deep explorations of grief.
Right.
What does it mean to lose someone who is your heart?
And
right?
suddenly,
right?
And in Joe Didion's case, her daughter had gotten sick, like septic, and was in the hospital. And like one night after visiting her, her and her husband are at the house like eating dinner, and he just drops dead.
Exactly.
So she's dealing with these like two grief, anxiety, stress. And then in Elizabeth Alexander's case, her husband also drops dead, but it's not tied to any other stress or grief.
Right.
It's really just like out of thin air.
Yeah. He's on the treadmill and has a coronary event. So but what I think is so interesting, and I totally agree with your assessment of like, here are two books about grief, but so different. Didion's is like, it's Didion, right? It's like precise and this like eagle-eyed perception and like observation, and she's describing everything. There's a kind of cold precision about it almost in that way that makes me love Joan Didion.
Yeah.
Like in the same way that she's describing someone take an LSD trip and the White Album,
right?
Like that's her gift, is she's like describing these epic things, but like as a total reporter. But Elizabeth Alexander, there's such a depth of emotion and I think rich is exactly the right word, a richness to how she talks about the contours of her grief.
Yeah. And like hearing you say that about Joan Didion, it's making me understand a little bit. Like one of the things that I really liked about the structure of this book is kind of in the beginning, they're kind of the chapters or the sections are like kind of longer and they're about her relationship with her husband, Fikre. I think that's how you say it.
I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but let's go with that.
I think that's what she put like phonetically. Anyways.
Okay.
With her husband, and it's kind of like you get to know them and you kind of – you hear about their life and their past and their history. And then after he passes, they're broken into these really short like staccato moments. Mm-hmm. And I feel like she does a great job of letting us feel what she's feeling through her writing and like through the structure. And I think that that is really different than Joan Didion, who's like more clinical and more removed. And that's also like the title, The Year of Magical Thinking. It's like this whole year about how she gets through this grief by like creating like this fantasy life for herself so she doesn't have to feel.
Yeah. Another thing that I love about this book, and I hadn't thought about this as being connected to Didion's title or actually what Didion's doing in that book, but I love the magic in this book and like the kind of – so she's talking about how her husband believed in the lottery and like, how he bought lottery tickets for her because he wanted to win the lottery. She talks about how they see this hawk devour a squirrel and that she believes that that actually, was a sign of what was to come with his death.
Mm-hmm.
She talks about how they saw, when her mother-in-law was dying, she saw a red fox cross a path, and she, in retrospect, realizes that that was like a sign that her mother-in-law was – there are all these elements of like magic and kind of the metaphysical and that I really love that she includes here. Because it's not Didion, it's not what Didion's doing where she's like engaging in magical thinking as a way to cope, but it's like Elizabeth Alexander admitting that she believes in this kind of invisible, this world of invisible forces, right. Which I just really appreciate as someone who like actually really is into astrology and right. is really into these things that I can feel kind of ashamed to admit right. when I'm trying to be a serious person.
Right.
yeah. But here's this brilliant, like tenured Yale professor who, you know, who read, wrote and read a poem for Obama's inauguration and is like right. quite serious as a scholar and artist, admitting that there's this, these kind of unknowable forces swirling around us that we can gain insight if we notice, you know, from right. if we notice.
Well, you can tell me no, you don't have to answer this. When my father passed away, I discovered a lot of like kind of supernaturally mm-hmm. things that I was like into or like that mm-hmm. helped me. Yeah. And I wonder if you kind of discovered that about yourself also after your aunt passed away. I have a very good girlfriend who is convinced that her mother is in butterflies. And wow. so every time like she'll be like on a hike and she'll be going through something hard and like a butterfly will like come and sit mm-hmm. by her and she's like, oh, that's my mom, you know? And like, yeah. I've heard that a lot. And you're right. It kind of, not in the exact same way in this book, like something so literal, but these supernatural things do come up. And I found them like when my father passed away, I was on an airplane. Mm. And I woke up to turbulence. And nobody knows if that was the exact moment that he passed away right. or not, but I'm convinced right. that it was. And I'm convinced that when I'm on a plane, because I hate flying and it gets really turbulent, that like that's my dad being yeah. like, it's okay, I got you. I wonder if you have had similar type things that you've discovered that maybe you never would have thought before you experienced the grief, but once you did.
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, I got to spend the last 3 weeks of my life, or the last 3 weeks of her life with my aunt as, mm-hmm. she, you know, as she was dying. And there was such a blessing in that, you know, that I got to be with her because I was living in Oakland at the time mm-hmm. and I came home and I was with her, you know, day in and day out. And I remember that when she was in the hospital, when she had a kind of mm-hmm. event occur that told us that we needed to take her to the hospital. Eventually I left to go get some things to bring mm-hmm. them back to the hospital so that I could be there for the night. And the moment I pulled in the driveway, my mom called to say she's gone. Mm. And I've always read that as like, my aunt didn't want me in the room when yeah. she passed. She I've didn't heard want this. Me by her side. I've heard that too, that like, people will wait until certain people are present or mm-hmm. away before they yeah. transition. And I really believe that. I think that she just didn't want me there
yeah.
when she passed away. So yes, there are certain things that I feel, and like no one can tell me different too.
Right.
You know what
exactly.
I mean? Like I don't like, really care your opinion yeah. on like, that's well, the science like an, says, like I don't care.
The wolf or like the fox.
Yes.
And it's like, sure, it could be or not. Like
right.
that's not actually important, but it's something that's like comforting
yes.
and also like maybe makes you feel more grounded
yeah.
in all your grief.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But yeah, I remember, so my, before my dad passed away, my mom's a really good friend. She had lost her mother and she'd like done a lot of hospice stuff and all this stuff. Mm. And so she gave me this book that was like about like telling your loved one it's okay to go or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I remember, even though my dad was really sick, I remember being like, this book is like such a joke, whatever. And then as soon as my dad passed away, I was like, this book is the most profound
yes.
thing I've ever read in my life. Like
right.
This has to have been true. Like my dad actually, this is like kind of a funny story, but he passed away the same day as Whitney Houston.
Oh, wow.
And my dad was always late. And I wasn't home. I was on my way home. But my mom said that like, that night before, that morning, he like woke up and was like, I gotta go meet somebody. I'm late. I can't be late for this, whatever. And my mom was like, you know. And then she was like, after my dad passed away in the morning and then like later in the day, the news came out about Whitney Houston. And my dad was like, and my mom was like, he was literally going to meet Whitney Houston. Like the only person he would ever be on time for is Whitney
That's
Houston.
Hilarious.
Like truly, what a joke. We're all idiots. He was just waiting. Like it wasn't me being like, it's time to go. It was literally like Whitney Houston's waiting
right,
for me.
I got it. It's time. Now's the moment.
But I do truly believe that he was waiting for Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
Like, 100%. He knew. He was like, I get to go have a concert with Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
Like, see y'all later.
Right. Yeah. And I love that her book gives us permission to,
right.
like, remember those things in our own lives and feel justified and
and hold on to those moments. One of the things that's also really beautiful and kind of supernaturally is the son, Simon, takes Elizabeth with him to heaven to see the dad.
That's beautiful.
Oh, I just got chills just thinking about it. That scene, that is just really I mean, it also makes me feel like, well, that kid is clearly those two people's kid. Like that. And, you know, he wasn't like six. He was like 12 or something. Like, he was like a full-sized kid. And I just felt like – I'm sure that it was special to her. But to read it as an outsider and be like, wow, I see the dad in him. I see the mom in him.
Yeah. And it also – that's one of the moments that makes me – feel certain that in my own family, I want an openness around death. Like, I want a culture of openness around talking about death, because I think that he would feel comfortable enough to say, like, do you want to go with me to visit dad? Okay, this is what I do. Okay, lay down on my bed.
Right.
I close your eyes. Right. Now, okay, now we're going here. Do you see it? Okay, now there's dad. Do you see him? Or, you know, like, bring her into his world. That's very vulnerable. You know, for anybody, but especially for a kid, to, and then also this piece of like, is this going to upset my mom too much? I think that's what I would, might worry about.
Yeah,
like, well, here I have this ritual that allows me to feel closer to dad, but if I bring my mom into this, is she going to break down in tears? And then I'm going to have to comfort her.
And I'm going to feel bad.
And I'm going to feel bad.
Right.
And so I, there are many ways in this book that I feel really, guided by the culture that they have in their family around, like, I'm in pain. I miss him. I'm suffering. How do you feel? Are you also in pain? Are you also suffering? Let's talk about it. How can we help each other? How can we be a support to one another? That feels really important to me. And as a parent of a young child, it was a good reminder. Like, I want that for us.
Yeah, totally. And he also says at the end, like, you can come and do this with me whenever you want. I don't think you're ready to do it by yourself.
Right.
Which I just loved. I'm like, he's like, this is kind of my thing. Like, you can come and hang out with me, but like, don't turn away. You're not quite ready, mom. You're not advanced.
But it's true. Like, there is, there does feel, and maybe it's because the children were there when he died and they saw him, and like, it was like a communal moment,
right?
It wasn't like they were at school and they came home and dad was just gone. Like, that trauma was
shared.
Yeah, shared and not closure, but like, yeah, shared, I guess. Just like something that they all saw and dealt with.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the other things I think the fullness of the book, the richness of this book is that it's not just her story, but it includes like recipes.
Yes.
And like poems from other people. And like, I like want to cook.
Me too.
Those foods.
I'm gonna make there's some. Like the shrimp barca. I'm on that.
Yeah. There's like three or four recipes in the book where I was like, yes, please, thank you for coming. But I think that like those are the things that also make a life. And more than just this book being about grief, this book is about this great love this family and this companionship and like a life really well lived.
Yeah, that's right.
Like a life that I was like, I would be happy to die at 50, I guess, if I knew that I could have like accomplished all this great stuff and been this person for so many people. Yeah. And like, he just seemed like such a wonderful,
incredible person.
Yeah.
So that's the other reason why I love this book is that it's like relationship goals for me. Mm-hmm. Like I read this book and I'm just like, what a love.
What a love.
I mean, it's just so beautiful. It's like they meet by chance at a coffee shop and then they, you know, they... He shows her his art studio and, you know, they just like fall in love with each other's stories. They meet each other's friends and it feels like family.
Right.
And they have these elaborate dinner parties. They just take such joy in food and conversation and having a house full of people they love. And they believe in each other fully. And it's just such a – that was the other reason I wanted to reread this because I think it, in some ways it's like an antidote against cynicism about relationships, about romantic love. And my book touches, you know, I feel like my third chapter about family and about so-called single parenthood, like there's a way in which you can read that as like a pretty cynical take on love relationships. I don't know. I mean, it's much more than that. It's a lot more than
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think they're reading this book is like a, it's a great reminder that, that like, you know, really complex, nuanced, fun, joyful, romantic love is possible. And that there can be a lot of joy in creating the culture of a family, you know, that right. you can be like living your life and enjoying your books and making your art and
right.
making your, you know, making your food. And then you find someone with whom you share these ideas about what makes for a good life. And I just appreciate that she lays it out on the page for us. She invites us into mm-hmm. All the ways in which they so enjoyed each other. And she, you know, she says, I think they were together for 17 years, married for 16 years, and that she takes us through the kind of evolution of their relationship, and that right. even though it was it ended too soon, there's so much that they were able to do together and make together.
Yeah, and like there's a section where she goes through like 16 Easters, like yeah. 16 Christmases, one fish feast of yeah. the seven fish, like this, and like chronicling a life in events and like shared mm. events. So that was a really special section. There were a few sections, I take notes when I read for the show, and there are a few sections where I was just like, wow, page 9. Like,
yeah.
Amazing, page 10. Right, which right. when I went back to look at the notes last night before like taking down my notes, I was like, I have to go back to read all these pages because I have no idea what wow 9 right. means. But right. And the other part of this, of their shared created world, is that they come from two very different worlds, right. which she talks about a lot. Like, what are the chances that we would have come together? Mm-hmm. What are the chances that, you know, this man from Eritrea and this woman from Harlem and that they were born like 2 months apart mm-hmm. and they find each other and they know right away.
Yeah.
Just like really magical.
Yeah, it is. Really it is. Magical. And it's a, she takes such care with like explaining, it's interesting how she writes about him as like, you know, he was a refugee who had to leave home as I think a teenager and, mm-hmm. you know, English was like his fourth language because he had learned all these other languages. Right,
and he ended up speaking like 7 or something yeah. crazy.
Yeah, but he had, you know, had to live in all these places because his, because Eritrea was war-torn and his mother sent him away. She handles like the telling of his story and like the geopolitical forces surrounding his story was in such a delicate way mm-hmm. so that he never becomes... I don't know. There's just such a, you somehow see him as a full person. You don't see him as defined by that refugee experience mm-hmm. or, you know, defined by being the chef, right? Or right. defined by being a visual artist. He somehow is, she brings him to life on the page as being all of these people and right. encompassing all of these experiences. And it's just such a, what a tribute, you know yeah. what I mean? Like, I'm not sure if she set out for it to be that, probably on some level, but like, what a beautiful tribute. I think, you know, I wrote my book thinking like, someday Isabel will probably read this and I hope that she feels good about what she reads.
Right.
And there's something satisfying in that. And I wonder how Elizabeth Alexander feels having read this. Does she feel like, yes, I poured what I could offer, you mm-hmm. know, to this beloved man into this book? Because if so, that must be such a satisfying feeling.
Right. And I wonder if her sons have read it yeah. or if they will read it.
Yeah.
And what they'll think.
It's dedicated to them.
Right. I'm sure they will. Don't you think you would want to?
I mean,
to?
They're like, I was trying to do the math. They must be nearly grown now, right? Because if they were yeah. like 12 and 13 and this book came out 4 years ago. Oh, no. They're teenagers. Older teenagers.
Well, I think, yeah, I think the older one, well, now 2019 came out 2015, which means, but he died in 2012
oh, right.
like, or right. 13, right?
Yeah.
So they're older. They're like 20s and 18, 20. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I in my version, there's like a little afterword oh. where I think she does mention that she hopes that they would read it one day, or, you know, mm-hmm. she talks about how the book, she took a year off from teaching to do the book, like a sabbatical to write the book. And yeah, I don't know where I was going with that. But anyways, I think she mentions that maybe they have read it or that she hopes that they will read it.
Yeah.
Kind of to tie this back into your book a little bit, you mentioned it, like the single black motherhood. Yeah. Obviously in this case, in the case of Elizabeth Alexander, it kind of, you know, happens to her.
Yeah.
She goes from being in a partnership and raising two children to being a single mother. But in your book, one of the things that stuck out to me about single Black motherhood was that its relationship to the patriarchy and how there it's like almost a safe space from patriarchy because it's so multi-generational and womanal, female.
Matriarchal, yeah.
Matriarchal is definitely the
correct word. No, I was with you.
I like womanal, though.
I like womanal, too.
It's not a definite no on womanal. But what do you, like, I don't know if you have thoughts about if it matters or if it, not that if it matters, but if it changes how the relationship to patriarchy is changed by the way in which a Black woman becomes a single Black mother.
Mm, interesting.
And I'm sure it does a little bit, but I just wonder if, like, in the end.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's important for children is that they have as many adults as possible who really love them and care about them. And so if that comes from having two parents of different sexes, like, great. If that comes from growing up with your mother and your grandmother, you know, also great. I write a lot in my book about the importance of extended family. You know, I didn't grow up with my father. I grew up with my mom and my Aunt Pam, who I mentioned, in the house. And then this larger network of, like, my other aunts and uncles and cousins, and then extended family in the neighborhood where I grew up. I grew up in the house that my grandfather's grandparents built. Mm. And so we had this whole extended network in the community. And so I've always believed that, you know, what kids need is love, and what kids need is adult attention and care.
Right.
And that it doesn't need to be defined in these, like, strict ways of the kind of nuclear family. And then also, you know, there's a way in which pro-marriage rhetoric, we have to listen to it. You know, we have to listen to, oh, well, I remember Mitt Romney during the 2012 presidential run-up talking about, he was asked some question during the debates about gun violence, and somehow he brought it back to, like, gun violence in Chicago, and somehow he brought it back to, like, there are too many, you know, Black female-headed households in Chicago. We also saw it with Obama, candidate Obama, talking about, you know, the perils of single female-headed households. And so this is, like, an equal opportunity shaming that we get from the right and the left. But I think a lot of these conversations happen without any acknowledgement of the history of Black family. You know, if you we survived enslavement, and that was a period during which parents couldn't lay any legal claim to their children.
Correct.
You know, a child could be sold away from you. You might fall in love or want to be a life partner with somebody, and that person could be killed or sold away from you. So there are these kind of kinship ties have always been tenuous, and we've built family in the best ways that we know how. And so I think in some ways, when we look at our family structures today, there, you know, we have to look at that in the larger historical context. But yeah, I think that growing up when you don't have to watch these kind of, like, power relations play out among your parents, you know, between your parents, where you're watching your mom cower because your dad says, like, dinner should be on the table, or like, your mom's telling you, like, wait till your father gets home, or, like, you're kind of, like, growing up surrounded by these ideas about who has power, who doesn't, whose needs matter more than others. I think that that's very dangerous and toxic. And so I'm happy to be, you know, trying to raise my child in a situation where her father is very present as a co-parent, and, like, they have a lovely relationship, and he and I have a great relationship too as co-parents and friends. But I think in a lot of these conversations, it's just assumed that marriage is the ideal way to raise a child. And sometimes we have to think more about what's actually going to work for the adults and the child or children in that situation.
Right.
And so with her, I mean, with Elizabeth Alexander, like, it's only loss,
right?
It's like nothing's gained by her husband being gone. It's only deep loss and sadness.
I just wonder how that changes the way that she approaches parenting. You know, like, if it feels like she's trying to hold space for him and that male authority, or if, I mean, I'm sure it's probably a lot of things, but I read these books back to back. So of course your book informed my thinking about this book. And I was thinking kind of like, you know, how does becoming a single parent through loss, mm-hmm. how does that shape her relationship to parenting yeah. and to the greater idea? Because, you know, she does then become a statistic, right? She then become a single black woman leading her household.
Wow. I hadn't even thought about that. It's true.
And I don't know what it means, but right. I feel like there is this element, and her kids are older, but it's two boys. You know, she has two sons. You have a daughter, which right. probably, you know, there's that dynamic too, that is probably different. You know, you, like you mentioned, your father wasn't in the home where you were raised, and you were raised by your mother and your aunt. So like you're a very matriarchal line. And right. I wonder, I don't know. It just brought up a lot of questions for me about how we look at single motherhood and if some form of it is legitimate, right? Mm-hmm. Or not. Like yours in your book kind of feels like a choice that you and your partner ended up making versus like if he had been taken to prison. Course.
Right. Or, and I do talk about that.
You know, like that there's That's all these right. different ways that black women can choose or be forced into single
That's right.
black motherhood. And I don't know. It like because it is so stigmatized and because there is so much pressure for marriage and that it seems like a failure.
That's right. That's so interesting.
There's just so much.
I hadn't even thought about like looking at this book through the lens of like, oh, Elizabeth Alexander becomes an unmarried black mom. And so like, how is she affected by the stigma? But I think one thing that's really lovely, there's the scene in the book where, you know, I think again, it's a dream. I love the role that dreams play in this book, but I think it's a dream. And then she wakes up and she has this dream that her husband is in some way. And she wakes up and she knows like, he's not in this house anymore. We need to leave this house. Mm-hmm. And so then she picks up her sons and they leave New Haven and move to New York City. And there's this beautiful scene where, you know, someone has, thrown them a party, like a welcome party. Mm-hmm. And so here's their community, right? Like here's their New York community welcoming them there. And so you get to meet like, you know, who we assume will become the people who are part of the daily fabric of their new right. lives. Similarly, like she does such a good job of showing in New Haven that while they have this beautiful nuclear family, they have, you know, their friends that come over for dinner and they, you know, her, you know, Alondra, like, I love that she's like naming all these famous people and using just their first name. Like, oh my God, is that Alondra Nelson? they have this, you know, their friends come in and out. They have their New Haven neighbors and people who are part of the Yale community. But I think it gets back to this idea, what I was mentioning earlier about community is being so critical when you're into family life, really, no matter what the structure is, right? Like I'm a single, you know, an unpartnered mom. And so it's like critical that I have other adults around me from my daughter's grandmothers and grandfather and aunt and, you know, my friends. It's critical that I have these other adults around me. But I think even if I were partnered, like I still would want us to be part of a rich community because that just makes everybody's lives better.
Totally.
So I think that that's, I think I didn't even, you know, apply that. I hadn't even thought about Elizabeth Alexander as a single mom because she immediately, when she decides we're leaving this house, he is no longer here. They're ushered into this new community that awaits them with open arms.
Yeah, it's true. Her life does feel like very full of humans.
Oh my gosh.
Doesn't it? It's like there's so many sister friends and she has a brother, but her parents are only children. That's so there's no aunts and uncles, no cousins.
No cousins.
And it just feels like she comes from a family of like a million people.
Right.
And he did. Fikre had a lot of relatives, but all over the world.
All over the world, yeah.
And that's the other part about this book. It's like so, I mean, she mentions the diaspora probably 500 times in the book, but it is. It's like they come from one place, they come from another place. There's family in Oakland, there's family in Paris, there's family in Italy. There's like this, I don't know. I mean, that's the thing about blackness that's so amazing is that it's so vast and it touches so many places in the world. And it's not like being Irish where you're from Ireland or like maybe you went to England or maybe you went to America. Mm-hmm. Like it's like you can be black and be anywhere and be rooted there and connected there, even though, of course, we didn't start out being rooted there.
Right.
But like now that you belong, you can belong in these places. And like, I don't know, I just thought that was really special.
I love that.
Like, it was like a it was not a practical. It was like a really, what's the word I'm looking for? It was really nice to see the diaspora in a family in that way, as opposed to like in your mind, like, I know Black people are everywhere, but like being like, this guy speaks Italian and like he cooks Italian food. He also cooks food from like all over and he has his own like mix. And I think in the beginning it's like, oh, is this authentic food? Yeah. And he's like, well, I mean, I made it.
Exactly.
And like it comes from my experience. And that is like so Black to me, mm-hmm. right? It's like, what does it mean to be Black? I don't know. Like, right. I'm Black and I'm living
I'm living it. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, I think that that's another reason why I love this book. There's this part where where do they go after her husband passes? Do they go to Italy to visit friends?
Maybe.
She takes the son someplace and it's like they're dear friends, and of course they miss, you know, her husband. But they're she writes about how she slept. She gets her first deep sleep since he's passed.
Yeah.
And I just love that because it's like, you know, and she's talking about like we're having our, you know, our like tapas and aperitifs or whatever. Like some – they're having their like little beautiful snacks out on some sun-drenched patio, and it just sounds so like lovely.
Mm-hmm.
But then – you know, she's like, I was able to actually get good rest because I was among people who were holding me mm-hmm. and I felt safe and held.
Mm.
And then there's like an earlier scene when she's describing when, you know, she and her husband, before they're married, when they first meet and she's still living and teaching in Chicago, and he comes and visits her and they have a dinner party and her friends are like checking him out and then quickly – and then get on the phone with her parents.
Right.
And they're like, okay, this is the man. This is how he loves her. Like, stamp of approval. But I love these scenes because it places them in different parts of that diaspora that you're talking about. And we see how they just fit so perfectly.
Right. That there's always a community there.
Yeah.
Like, that there's always a sense of belonging,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know that I feel that in my day-to-day life, that I like belong in a lot of different communities. But then when I think about it, I'm like, I do have communities all over, mm-hmm. not international so much, but you know, I lived in New York and I'm from Oakland and I'm here in LA and like all the places that I've been and all the people. And you know, like you have a friend who has a wedding somewhere and you're like, oh, my other friend lives here.
Right.
And like that you, and that that is like, I mean, that to me is so much part of life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I grew up similar, I think, to Simon and Solomon, that like my parents were always hosting.
Mm.
And so that is something that like my husband and I love to do now too. And like to see that in her story, I felt really, like we were talking about last week, I felt really seen like in this memoir in that way, that those spaces, like when we open up our home to our friends and our family, that that is really valuable to other people's lives. It's because I feel selfish. I'm like, I love hosting. I love having people be at my house. I don't have to go anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Like I can just do it at my house. I can do it my way. And like, I can like control the whole situation.
Right.
But that it's meaningful.
Absolutely. And that people love getting those invitations.
Yeah. It really is. So that made me feel really nice.
Yeah. And that, again, like that's just, this book is so many things because it, like I said, you know, their love is relationship goals, but it's really life goals.
Yeah.
Like I just it feels like a real reminder that, you know, you can build your life in this way.
Right.
To have to be filled with beauty and friends and great food and laughter and great art.
And then when something goes wrong, you have that community to hold you and help you and heal you in ways. There's a Lucille Clifton poem in here that I really want to read because it like took my breath away, but now I have to find it. On my copy, it's on page 94, children.
Okay, let's see.
So it's
mine too.
A Lucille Clifton poem about her husband's passing, and it's called The Death of Fred Clifton, 11-10-84, age 49. She says, I seem to be drawn to the center of myself, leaving the edges of me in the hands of my wife. And I saw with the most amazing clarity, so that I had not eyes but sight, and rising and turning through my skin, there was all around, not the shape of things, but oh, at last, the things themselves.
Hmm.
And the poem is from the perspective of Fred Clifton as he's dying in Lucille Clifton's imagination of what he was experiencing as he's dying. And I'm like not really a poetry person. I'm new to poetry. And that one really just like landed for me. Like yeah. I was like, whoa, okay.
Yeah. No, it's lovely. Yeah. I mean, I think, it's a lovely poem. I'm also not like that practiced in talking about poetry, but the thing that really hits me about this is I just love anything that invites us to think deeply about death.
Yeah.
You know, anything that gives us permission to acknowledge whatever emotions come up when we think about death, whether that's fear or like release, you know, a kind of longing for that freedom and release. Right. Because I think that's not something many of us feel permission to do. I think, you know, a lot of us deal with death as something to be afraid of, and so something not to talk much about. And so I really appreciate all the ways in which Elizabeth Alexander is like inviting us into different people's perspectives of death and what it felt like, what it meant for them, how it changed their lives.
Right. And like in this poem, it also feels like a communal event, right? That like he sees his wife, and as he pulls inward, there she is and there they are. And that, you know, as he's leaving, he's not alone. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really, really powerful. And you're right. Like we have this fear around death. And I think some of it is like the unknown and not being in control and all that stuff. And I think the other part of it is the grief and the sadness and that people don't want to talk about death because they're worried that someone else might get upset.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this a little bit on the show in the past. Like, you're never going to make me more sad about my dad having died than I already am by bringing it up. Like, it's constantly with me. Like, I'm sure for you when it comes to the day of your aunt's passing or maybe her birthday and like people don't reach out to you or whatever because they're worried. I don't want to make her sad.
Right.
And you're like, I didn't forget this day. Like, this is a day that I'll always remember. Yeah. This day is like seared in my being.
Right.
And that we're too scared to upset people, even though I find that like the most comforting thing is my best girlfriend always like will text me or say something about my dad, like on or on the day that he passed.
Yeah.
Or this year on Father's Day, one of my other best friends texted me and was like, I was just thinking about the day I met your dad.
Yeah.
And like, that was so special for me because of course I'm thinking about my dad on Father's Day when all of you guys are posting all your cute dads in the 70s with their mustaches and stuff. And I'm like, look at your cute dad. Like, of course I'm thinking about that, but that we're scared to engage with people who have experienced death or people who are on the verge of death. Like, I'm really bad with sick people, like terminal people. For some reason, it just really freaks me out. And I know this about myself, and I really, it's like, makes me sad about, like, I don't know, I'm like embarrassed about it, even though I know it. I just, I don't know, because I don't have that relationship with death, and like, I've not really been coached through it or walked through it or really experienced it except for my own father.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's just so much around death where we've like villainized it because it's hard or sad, and we don't want to feel uncomfortable or, you know, and I
absolutely,
like, if we could sit in it more and talk about it more and be okay with it more.
Yeah.
I think
we'd be the better for it.
Yeah.
I think we'd be the better for it. Yeah. No. And I mean, I so appreciate you saying that. My aunt's birthday is July 4th. And so it just passed. And yeah, it just makes me feel better when people reach out and say, you know, just acknowledge I'm thinking of her today.
Right.
You know, I know you must be too. And I think that this book, you know, there's a part where the author says, nobody cried today. She says, I remember my mom saying this when I was about, you know, I was six and my sibling was four or something like that. And my mom said, oh, today is a different day because it's the first time in 6 years that nobody, first day in 6 years that nobody's cried. And then Elizabeth Alexander says, like, I didn't cry today.
Right.
You know, today's the first day since my husband died that I didn't cry. And I just appreciate the kind of like saying, you know, writing, laying out, these are the ways that we mark our grief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did I cry today? I don't remember her getting into this much in the book, but it's something I think about. Like, am I fully giving myself over to the grief, or am I repressing it in a way that's going to be dangerous for me down the road, you know?
Right.
But just all these ways that I think it's important to reflect on our relationship to death. And, you know, she writes at one point that her sons tell her, like, "Mom, we could always hear you weeping in the garden." Mm-hmm. She thinks she's quietly going out in the garden to
cry.
Love
that.
Yeah.
I love her kids.
I love it. Yeah, they're great.
They're great.
You know, even that, even having someone say, like, "We hear you crying."
Yeah, like, "All right, lady."
Right, like, why are you trying to pretend? Exactly, like, we're crying too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just, this book has been helpful to me. You know, there's a line in here that was so meaningful to me when my aunt passed away. She says, I don't even know if I have it marked, but she keeps repeating, like, "Where did you go? Where did you go?" And I just remember having that question in my mind too. It's very strange when someone dies mm-hmm. because you can still feel their presence, mm-hmm. but then, you know, for a while you can trick yourself into thinking they're just away on a trip or whatever. And it's like, where are you? Where is your spirit? Where does it reside? Is it just swirling all around me now? Is it off in some other far corner of the universe? Like, and I just, and I think the line is something like, "Where did you go? I thought that we were all you needed." Mm. Almost this sense of like abandonment.
Right. Because I was part of it too.
Yeah.
Not like a blame, but just like, you left. This is sad. This sucks.
Yeah.
I wonder, you mentioned that you hope that you'll have like a space for death in your own family. Mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas of how you will do that?
I don't really. Because even, you know, we'll talk about like my aunt being, you know, my daughter will say like, "Aunt Pam passed away," right? Okay. Or she'll talk about, but she doesn't know what that means. And I don't know how to really talk about it with her because it is such a mystery. How do you choose to verbalize what that means?
Right.
So I don't know yet specifically how I want to do it, but I just know that I want us to always be able to talk about it and not to feel, embarrassed about, you know, our grief. So I think it'll be another, you know, just like with this book, I had a ton of questions about being pregnant and parenting. I think I'll learn by just asking people who seem to do it well.
Right. Yeah. Because that's also feels like such a private thing that I wonder, like, how will you know when other people do it well? Like, it's, even if your home is a place where you talk to your daughter about grief, like, I wonder if people would know that if they came into your home for dinner, you know, like, it just, I wish that it was like something that we did talk about and like could talk about. I don't know. Maybe I'm just going to start talking about it more.
Yeah.
I have to say, on this show, we've had like 3 or 4 episodes this year about grief or like related to death or terminal illness and stuff, which is, this is our second year, but it's really, that was not something we talked about at all last year. And I don't know why this year, I don't know if it's like my guests have been really into it or I've wanted to talk about it, but I hear so much feedback from people like that it is valuable to hear about and talk about, which I just, I mean, that makes me feel nice. I always feel nice when people tell me that they like what we're talking about on the show, but specifically around grief and like very different books about it. Like, we talk about it a lot. We talked about it a lot. A few weeks back, we did a book called The Unwinding of the Miracle, which was by Julie Yip Williams. And it's her memoir about dying from cancer.
Oh, yes, of course.
And so that one obviously is like really in your face.
Yeah.
And that one was a lot about like what it's like to be dying and to deal with that. But in this book, it's so much more about like, what does it mean to survive and be the one who lives and carries on? And how do we do that and hold a place for someone who's passed, but also, you know, continue creating the world that we live in? Just like so much.
It is. And I think it's one, it's, you know, like, it's so invisible. Like, there's no space in our culture for letting people grieve. Right. So especially if like you didn't lose a parent or your partner or something,
right,
like
or
your
child or someone or very close.
Cause I remember after my aunt passed just being like, I actually need some time.
Right.
I need some time here. Like, I'm not going to work. And luckily I was in a flexible working situation and they were understanding, but, I think we need these conversations because we need to create more of a culture around letting people grieve and acknowledge that it's like a serious process and that it doesn't finish, you know, in like a week or something, after the memorial service, you're not kind of done. And I also think that there's a way in which, like, people are dealing with grief. This isn't related to death necessarily, but I think in the years, like, in our, given our current political situation, mm-hmm. there's a lot of grief that we experience because we hear these reports of 8-year-olds caring for 3-year-olds and, right. you know, detained at the border. And yeah. we're like, how is this a country where I live? And what do I do about it? And I think there's a way in which after the election of 2016, people felt, people entered a period of grief. And so I think that there's a way that we just need to talk more about the grief is a legitimate emotion that we all experience, you know, for different reasons and right. that what are the ways that we can help each other through.
Yeah. Now you have me thinking about other kinds of grief besides like a passing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's also, I mean, there definitely was like a sense of like mourning after Trump was elected and inaugurated for the Obama presidency. Mm-hmm. Also like what, you know, and I think obviously that same thing was true like when JFK was assassinated, not just a mourning of his life loss, but also the loss of the ideas of his, yeah. of his, you know, future for America. Right. Yeah.
And when the present situation is such a backlash against what right. so many people felt excited about.
Right. Exactly.
How do you make yeah. sense of that?
You know what? We're still trying to make sense of it. And I feel like we're going to be trying to make sense of what's going on now for a long time.
Yeah.
Like I'm very curious to see like future generations, how they'll teach now in school. If they do teach it. Because I remember when I was a kid, they like barely taught like Vietnam.
Yeah. You know, anything like, after the Vietnam it was War like, got left off. Yeah.
Well, I feel like it was like, okay, Civil War, Civil Rights, Vietnam, Clinton. And I was like, right. okay. It's like, that feels quick. Clinton yeah. was just right after the Civil War. It's like 10 years later. But I hope, I mean, like, there, I'm sure there will be, like, millennium history, like, in colleges where it'll be, like, 2000 to 2020. Mm-hmm. And, like, what was this time? And, like, that it ended, you know, with the 2020 election, fingers crossed. And, like, that's, like, the ushering of a new era, you know, like, from 9/11 to Trump,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah, yeah.
I feel like that'll be a history yeah. class for sure.
Right.
And like the rise of white nationalism and like the progressive left and like, I don't know, I'd take that class.
I would too.
Someone teach
being,
it.
Yeah, it's being taught right now.
It's being taught right now or it's getting created. Mm-hmm. So before we finish up, I always like to talk about the title and the cover. We have two different editions. You have the hardcover mm-hmm. And I have the like paperback that has the Pulitzer sticker and they're actually pretty different. But I think, is the art on yours also by Fikre? Because the art on mine is. It says that the cover painting
is
Fikre's. Yeah.
Jacket painting, Solitary Boat in Red and Blue by Fikre. Yeah.
I feel like even the I'll link to pictures of both so you guys can see it in the show notes. But yeah. I feel like even the pictures on the cover of our books are like pretty different looking.
Very
like they
different.
Don't look like they're by the same artist at all.
Okay. Yours have the angels that she describes at some point in the book.
Yeah. But was the boat described in the book?
I don't remember that either.
Mm-hmm.
But you're immediately introduced to, she writes so much about his color palette.
Yeah, his colors.
That where the colors came from, that she can see, you know, touches of his mother's kitchen.
Right.
And the landscape in Eritrea. And it's so both of our covers, you know, give you a taste of that, these rich colors. And the on your cover, it's the... Do you remember the context in which she's talking about the angels?
I don't quite remember the context.
Me neither.
It's also just another nice tribute to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I mean, I think that, of course, she would do it. Like, it would seem crazy to have anything else on the cover of her book talking other than his art. But it also feels really nice that it is his art. Like, it feels right.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I had never even checked to see who did that art. I am very curious to see an image of him. I searched the internet. Did you?
I did. I Googled her and I saw him.
Yeah.
He's handsome like she described.
Sure.
He was handsome just like she described. Yeah. They looked very happy. He did have a great smile. Like all the things she said were true, his bald head.
Mm-hmm.
What about the title?
The title, The Light of the World. Well, I mean, so you don't have to get very far into the book to see that or to understand that he was the light of her world and of their family's world. And so that just kind of tells you... There's not a lot of complexity in the book around, like, I think there's one sentence where she says, of course we had our challenges like any married couple, but for the most part,
yeah.
That's like the one moment right. That you get even a hint that they had any kind of
right.
strife, marital strife. But yeah, I think the title tells us straight up, like, I'm about to tell you about this incredible being who
right.
I had the privilege of knowing for 17 years. But it also...
It's in the epigraph.
Yes.
I think in all three of them, it talks about that.
Yes.
But then also the second one, the Oh Beauty, You Are the Light of the World, mm-hmm. that's what's on his bench at his memorial or his gravestone.
And that comes from a poem by Derek Walcott called The Light of the World. And I believe Derek Walcott was her mentor.
Oh, really?
I think at some point she talks about him being her mentor.
Yeah. I like the title a lot. I think it's very straightforward. I think the book, as artistic and beautiful and complex as it is, it also is very straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that the title is really good. My only thing about the title and my cover with the angels is I thought it was going to be like very Christian-y.
Oh, interesting.
And it's not.
No, not at all.
But like it kind of like the light of the world and like seeing the angels, I was like, is this going to go into like a very God place?
I could see how you think that. Yeah.
But your book looks totally different. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I do think it's interesting. I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but like a cover says a lot about
really
a book.
Does, yeah.
It really, really does. And I think that like when you get it right, it can be so important. And when you not even just get it wrong, but when you just kind of don't hit it right on, mm-hmm. it allows the reader to like go in with a lot of, mm-hmm. like, I wasn't super excited about this book based on this cover.
Yeah. I can see why.
Like the cover's kind of just like blah to me, but once I got going in the book and then I looked on the back and I saw it was his art, like it clicked, mm-hmm. but I still was kind of like, eh.
Yeah, it's funny. I hadn't given that much thought. So I am part of a book club. I do want to mention this. Even though I said like, oh, I barely read, but I am part of a book club.
A shout out.
That I've been in for almost a decade.
Oh, wow.
And it is made up of, it was Christina Rizga, who's an education reporter. She writes a lot for Mother Jones. Or I'm sorry, she writes a lot for The Atlantic now. Okay. She was on staff at Mother Jones for a long time. She got us all together. Jamila King, who is a journalist who writes for Mother Jones right now. And Gavin Leonard, who's an organizer who's based in Ohio. And the four of us got to know each other because we all were in some way connected to Wiretap, which was an online publication that Christina was the editor and publisher of. Maybe like 15 years ago, we all got to know each other through Wiretap. So anyway, we are in a book club, and that's how I initially read this book. I can't remember which of our members suggested it. I think I may have, because I knew it was about grief and I was like, guys, I need this right now. But that I wanted to just do a shout out to, we call ourselves the think tank because we do read books, but like the books are kind of secondary. It's just an opportunity once a month to check in with one another. We kind of, help each other problem solve and troubleshoot. Mm-hmm. We just really all trust each other's minds. And so it's a way that we can keep up with each other. We do it via Google Hangout, but that's one way that I get introduced to books that I read. And it's certainly how I was introduced to this book.
I love that. That's so good. That's more of your finding community, like-minded
yes,
community.
Exactly.
That's so good. Anything else that you want to say about this book or anything in general?
No, I don't think so. I just appreciate the opportunity to talk about this book and my book and books in general.
Yay, me too. Thank you for being here. Of course, Dani's book is called We Live for the We, The Political Power of Black Motherhood. It's out in the world. Go get your copy. And then the book we discussed today is The Light of the World by Elizabeth Alexander, which, as we mentioned, has been in the world for a few years. So go check that out. Thank you, Dani, so much for being here.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure talking with you.
Yay. And you guys, we will see you in the stacks. That does it for us today on The Stacks. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thank you to Dani McLean for being our guest. Everything we talked about today can be found in the show notes. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, go to patreon.com/thestacks. To redeem your free 30-day Audible trial and a free audiobook download, go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review.
Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.